Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, WISO's Juliet Fromholt talks with local artist Terry Welker. We've got Politics Ohio. Up first, a WISO Community Voices triple play from producers Kristen Wicker, Susan Burns, and our first story, Wally Ream. At the Glen Helen Nature Preserve near Yellow Springs, there's a problem. For decades, non-native plants such as bush honeysuckle have been taking over the understory of the forest. The preserve received a $70,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy to remediate these invasive species. The target for the South Glen Restoration Project is a 2.5-mile stretch alongside the Little Miami River, an area the size of 80 football fields. Each Saturday this year, volunteers join staff as they attempt to reclaim the forest. Community Voices producer Wally Ream went to visit.
George Beery is land manager at Glen Helen Nature Preserve.
Tell me what you just did.
Well, I limbed a very large honeysuckle. That sucker is 8 inches at the base, easy.
How long would it have to be here to grow to that size?
50 years. This is what we call a mother plant. So if they came in 65, what is that, 50 years, more or less.
On this Saturday morning, Beery is leading a team of 9. Mostly volunteers.
So this is big stuff, guys. It doesn't get much worse than this.
We can't even do an acre of this a day. It's too intense. We realize now that this oxbow is the most difficult we found.
In the oxbow section of the South Glen, the honeysuckle is all around. It grows in clusters and has long, arching trunks. Imagine a drooping flower bouquet, only 10 feet high, and instead of blossoms, a thick tangle of branches and leaves. I interrupt Andy Wilson of Fairborn and ask him to explain what he and the other volunteers are doing.
Well, they've cut large amounts of the invasive plants, the olive and the honeysuckle and a few other things, and it's in piles in the woods, and we're grabbing onto the cut limbs and trunks and dragging them to where they're chopping them up so they can make other piles out of it.
There's lots of chopping going on. Where it's possible, the managers prefer to use a huge chipper to pulverize the plants. But this section of the glen is remote, and today the tool of choice is the machete. Rachel Smith is an Antioch College student. She chose this project for her spring internship.
Had you ever used a machete before this?
Yeah, I spent my last year in Ecuador and Colombia, so I'm pretty familiar with using machetes. I really enjoy using them. They're incredibly useful, and if you get a feel of how to do them, I think they're a really efficient way to work.
How about the one George gave you? Was it as sharp as...
It was a good one. I switched him out because I was using the orange one, which I hate. I don't like the ones that have a safety handle, so he gave me a heavier one that was just sharpened, and it was a lot better.
The grant from the Land Conservancy pays for 2 temporary employees who help lead the volunteer workdays. In prior years, there were occasional fall work weekends at the Glen, but progress was slow.
What we were seeing was that you could go out and get a bunch of people together and over a course of a month or two, maybe clear an acre.
Nick Budis is director of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute.
But do the math. We have a 1,000-acre preserve, and if you were taking out an acre of invasive species every year, you were putting yourself on the 1,000-year plan. And we really sought to accelerate our efforts because we didn't think that the glen could wait that long to heal. And frankly, we were just far too impatient to wait that long ourselves.
The current glut of non-native plants traces back to home landscaping projects in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Emmer honeysuckle, for example, was introduced as an ornamental from Asia. Birds ate the seeds and carried them, and the plant escaped cultivation. Buddhist explains that the glen's shape makes it vulnerable. It's narrow, about 1/3 mile wide by 4 miles long.
We really try and help enforce the idea that a honeysuckle plant that's right outside of the glen might as well be inside the glen, and invasive species that are in our backyards will ultimately spread to natural areas and give people the knowledge and the tools to help be good stewards of their backyards and their communities. That's how you protect natural areas.
How many times do you think you've come after bush honeysuckle?
Oh, probably at least 20 now.
Again, Andy Wilson.
Been doing it for about 4 or 5 years.
It does seem like a Herculean task. What do you think keeps you coming back?
Just clearing a little bit at a time and seeing how good the woods look when you clear it and seeing the wildflowers come back. You've got to start someplace. So if you clear a little bit and keep on going.
Brian Ryan is a volunteer from Xenia. He sprays herbicide on a large honeysuckle stump.
Is that wet enough?
Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta hit those really big ones twice. Let it soak in. And
okay.
Come back to it.
Okay. That's primed.
It seems like a big task. Do you find that daunting at all?
I used to be in construction, so how you have to look at it is you have to look at this is my little square for the week. You can't look at the whole building. I mean, you know, we did high rises, and you know, like you couldn't say there's 20 stories. You had to say I'm going to do 1/8 of one floor this week. That's it.
Vincent Lano of Enon volunteered over 100 times at the Glen before being hired as temporary staff for the project.
Do you have any particular feelings about honeysuckle?
Well, it's like a bully, you know, the school bully. This is the woods bully. And you can't just let it go on without taking action. Its intention is to steal all the light from every other plant. And that's a bully. It's like someone who comes up in school and says, "Give me your lunch money." Well, and we can't have that.
Our land manager has a map in his office.
Again, Nick Budis.
He has an orange highlighter, and as they complete an area, he extends a little box around where that land was and is gradually able to watch the orange grow on the map along the Little Miami. We're making good progress, but it is a big, big project. We can use some help.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Wally Ream.
Poison ivy.
No, that's okay. All great.
This way, Brian. That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm trying.
I like the looks of that one.
Antioch College and the University of Dayton have teamed up to sponsor a visit by environmental artist Basha Erland this month. Erland is internationally known as a pioneer in the field of eco-art. She conducts community-oriented projects designed to aid in restoring the health of waterways. Erland's project for the Dayton region began with a summer exhibition of artwork at Antioch's Herndon Gallery and continues in September with events at the University of Dayton. Producer Susan Burns reports.
50 college students are gathered in a large circle at Island Metro Park in Dayton. They've just kayaked several miles down the Great Miami River, and now they're creating river sound poems with visiting artist Basha Erland. The students are river stewards from UD's Rivers Institute. They've been eagerly awaiting Erland's visit for months. So, what can an artist teach us about rivers? Rivers Institute coordinator Leslie King explains how Erland, an eco-artist, provides an important perspective.
She's an artist that uses the natural world around her, particularly water, to make art that brings awareness to environmental issues and to community issues. And that fits in alignment with what the Rivers Institute's trying to do with bringing people back to the river to help restore the river's health and our community's health.
Eco-art, a practice that combines the arts with ecology, has evolved since the 1970s in response to increasing environmental degradation. Over the past three decades, Erland has worked on water issues in Africa, Europe, South America, Southeast Asia, Canada, and the U.S.
One of the things that I do are to take these blocks of ice and hand carve them into the form of a book, which to me is a very interesting sculptural metaphor for learning and for things that we can know about our environment. And then I meet with botanists and various biologists and plant specialists and community members and tribal elders to decide what are the best seeds for any particular riparian zone, the riparian zone being the banks of the river. These seeds are then embedded into the books, so it becomes a kind of text. So we will be working with students, faculty, community members, carving a series of these ice books And then we will have various events at the river where these icebooks will be put into the river.
When the floating icebooks melt, the seeds are released into the river and eventually wash up on the bank. As grown plants, they'll improve the river's ecosystem.
This is Canada Wild Rye.
Erlin consults Michelle Banker, the land resource manager at the Marianist Environmental Education Center, about potential seeds to include in the icebooks.
That gets stuck on everything. Yeah.
So they're very, very visible. So a good feature.
Erlin makes these beautifully crafted, poetic objects to address waterborne disease, the health of rivers, and water scarcity.
We simply can't survive. We can survive without food. We cannot survive without water. It's important for us to think about future generations, not just our generation. Hopefully, through our actions, any of our actions for the better, that these actions reverberate out. The more people there are, for instance, working for the health of our rivers, the better. And I think that each one of us individually provides a kind of example for how others might move forward. So it's not any one person, it's not what I'm doing, it is all of us working together.
Erlin's visit was made possible through a partnership between the University of Dayton and Antioch College. Basha Erlin's artwork is on display at UD's Art Street through September 16th. Erlin will deliver a public lecture on Thursday, September 13th, and lead a community parade to launch icebooks into the Great Miami River on Friday, September 14th. For more information about Basha Erlin's visit and public events, go to www.udayton.edu/arts. This is Susan Burns reporting for WYSO.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO. For almost a year, small businesses have been popping up in downtown Dayton as part of Activated Spaces, an all-volunteer organization run by young professionals. Its pop-up projects pairs local entrepreneurs with downtown property owners to transform vacant spaces into vibrant storefronts. Producer Kristen Wicker visits the newest pop-up shop, So Dayton.
This is the sound of a dream becoming reality as the owners of downtown Dayton's newest pop-up shop, So Dayton, mop floors and move furniture to ready their space in the Oregon District. So what are folks going to see when they first come into the front door of So Dayton?
Maybe one fabric round right here, a couple shelves on the walls with fabrics, notions, patterns. We have a whole garage full of vintage stuff, but we're going to try to pick all the coolest stuff.
That was Tracy McElfresh, who is opening So Dayton with fellow seamstress and designer Jesse Anderson.
But we want the fun, fashionable fabrics that you can make dresses out of, you can make bags out of, you can do kids stuff, accessories, really anything and all. We just want it to be trendy, but a little vintage.
So Dayton, and that's S-E-W Dayton, joins five other pop-up shops downtown. Scott Murphy is a volunteer with Activated Spaces. He's been involved with the project since the organization first started looking at national models to meet its goal to fill now vacant storefronts with local art and small businesses.
We send out invitations to property owners who want to participate and ask them to be willing to lease their space on a short-term basis and being willing to offer their space below market value. So that's one half of the pop-up equation. The second half is we make a call to the community, to business owners and entrepreneurs who want to start a shop downtown, and we market it as an opportunity to try out their business concept at a minimal risk on a short-term basis and at the same time bring vibrancy to downtown, and it's just a win-win for everybody involved.
I mean, there's lots of retail centers and cities in the Dayton area that have vacant storefronts. Why downtown Dayton?
The organizations that help run Activated Spaces, two of which serve young professionals, Generation Dayton and Up Dayton, and we've heard over and over from the constituents that we work with about the importance of downtown, that a center city is critical to young talent attraction retention. So the opportunity to work on a project like this was right in our wheelhouse.
Lisa Scott is the owner of Beauty Box, a pampering day spa that opened in November 2011 during the first phase of the pop-up project.
The process has been great. They give us a lot of support. It allows us to focus and really nail down what it is our business needs.
Fellow pop-up Vintage Barber Shop, part of the project's second phase in May of this year, is located next door to Beauty Box. Together, the two shops have filled the once vacant street-level space in the Wise Building on West 5th Street, owned by Tom Rezuskas.
All the volunteers have just been tremendous. They work very hard, and if it wasn't for them, stimulus downtown probably wouldn't be as great as it is.
Indeed, shop owners say that, while in many cases they hope to open downtown regardless, the volunteer power of the pop-up project makes it much more realistic to do so. Jesse Anderson said it would have been very confusing to open So Dayton without the support.
They have just been completely helpful and caring and want to see us succeed, and they want to see us succeed in Dayton.
As part of the pop-up project, we've helped spur a retail movement downtown. We've seen more and more shops start since the pop-up project got started. It's helped reinforce their success and the success of business owners that have been here for a while and were here before the pop-up project started.
Again, Activated Spaces volunteer Scott Murphy.
The response that we've got from property owners and business owners around the community for interest into the program justifies seeing it continue. We hope that one day it's not needed for downtown Dayton, that the market, say, will take over, but we see Activated Spaces and the pop-up project filling that need until that happens.
So Dayton will open Friday, September 14th, in conjunction with the Fall Urban Nights, a downtown-wide arts festival when visitors can check out the city's many restaurants, galleries, and retail shops, and, of course, chat with business owners like Tracy McAlfresh.
We wanted to bring something fun to Dayton. We wanted to be a part of the community that Dayton is with all the shops down here. We still were going to find a shop here in Dayton, but I don't think it would have happened as well and as easy if it wasn't for Activated Spaces and pop-up shops.
Reporting for WISO's Community Voices, this is Kristen Wicker.
For more information about WISO's Community Voices project, visit WISO.org and sign up for our mailing list. Join us next Tuesday and Sunday for more new work from WISO's latest Community Voices producers.
When you live in a small town, it's almost impossible to hide who you really are. But that doesn't mean people won't try.
We were trying to figure out the perfect lie to tell everybody at work and to tell my daughter and to tell my grandkids. What would people believe?
Dark Secrets and Truth Tellers in the Missouri Ozarks. That's on the next State of the Reunion.
This evening at 6 on your public radio station, WYSO.
They say variety is the spice of life, so tune in to Alpha Rhythms, the one spice you've been missing. Each Sunday night from 8 to 11 p.m., your hosts Jerry, Julie, and I will take you on a sonic journey, venturing through the best in new age ambient, electronic, and otherwise worldly music, safely returning you in time for the morning commute. Your Sunday nights just got a lot more interesting. That's Alpha Rhythms, Sunday evening from 8 to 11 p.m., right here on 91.3 WYSO.
This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Politics Ohio. Next Friday is Urban Nights in downtown Dayton. There'll be lots of things to see and hear around the city, including the unveiling of the You Are Here project at Courthouse Square. Earlier this week, WYSO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with local artist Terry Welker about the project, beginning with its origins.
So the You Are Here project began as an idea to create an art installation to transform the courthouse, to get people to pause and think and consider the possibility of celebrating the fact that you are here in Dayton, Ohio, and taking pride in that. Whether you're from the suburbs or whether you're from a surrounding county, we all, to a certain degree, gather our identity from the center of our place here, which is the downtown, and in the middle of downtown, which is probably the most public place we have, the most memorably public place that we have in the city is Courthouse Square, and that wonderful object that sits in the middle of it. So I also want to say a big shout out to Dayton History for working with us and a number of other organizations that have been supportive of the cause. And so we're going to have fun on Urban Nights as we transform the courthouse.
I've been hearing rumblings about this and seeing little signs and symbols throughout the summer, but this is kind of the big unveiling, if you will, on Urban Nights, it seems.
Yes. We ran a couple of pilot projects, one earlier at the Spring Urban Nights down at the Yellow Cab building, and we had a couple of thousand people come by and participate in Christina Parema's project, which was a lot of fun, where people became really expressive in a very slow manner. But we have this big, giant map of the world that not just – it has everything in the universe on it. It has, obviously, a lot of text on it, including heaven, hell, nirvana, Neverland, places that people identify with in terms of where they've been and where they're going, and help us to, you know, consider the possibilities. Like, what does it mean to consider you are here? So the more we've explained this idea, the more gravity it's gathered over time. So we did that as a rollout, as an experiment to see how people would react to the idea. And currently the You Are Here map, as well as some artist interpretations of the old courthouse itself, are currently on display at the Dayton Visual Arts Center for a couple of weeks. And then we're going to be moving that artwork to the old courthouse for Urban Nights, where a number of other things are going to occur.
Tell us about those other things. I know you've got quite the impressive list of collaborators. I saw some great spoken word artists on there. There are visual artists. It seems like you've got people from all over the community that are somehow pitching in and offering what they can to this transformation.
The project is what we call an open source idea. That means it's shared through the community. Nobody owns it. It doesn't require consensus to adopt the idea. You just give credit where credit is due. And it's open to multiple interpretations. So that means this is something that's easy for people to adopt in their own way. If you ask, well, am I allowed to do this here or there? Can I use this? The answer is yes. There'll be things going on inside the courthouse as well as outside. Inside the courthouse, the beautiful oval room has got wonderful acoustics. And so what better place for the spoken word? And if you ask the question, well, what would Paul Laurence Dunbar be saying? We have our own contemporary poet, Sierra Leone, and a group of friends who's going to be performing that evening inside the courthouse. We also have music, live music, and then also participating in that is Chris Shea, as many of you may know from Free Shakespeare. And again, we'll have the artwork that will be from various local artists that will be inside there, as well as our You Are Here map that people can participate with. Who doesn't like stickers, right? So that'll be happening inside. And then outside, you'll know that we're there because one of the big pieces we're going to have is a giant helium-filled balloon that has our famous arrow that says You Are Here on it, floating over the courthouse, in front of the courthouse. How big is it?
That's about 15 feet tall.
Right. Filled with helium. It's a Macy's-style balloon. And so that'll be a fun, exciting moment. It'll be a photo op for you and your friends if you're on Courthouse Square walking by or want to identify yourself with the world as being in Dayton. This is the place to do it. One of the things happening on the street for the first 3 hours, say from like 5 to 8 o'clock, Glenna Jennings is going to have a photo booth where she's going to be doing, I would say, portraits of the community during that time period. And what will happen about 8 o'clock as dusk sets in, we're going to turn the lights on the courthouse off, and we're going to be doing full-scale projections of those portraits in a kaleidoscope fashion, actually, on the courthouse. So from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock, John Rensel with Light Fantastic has graciously donated his time and effort to facilitate working with Teresa Oliveria and Glenna Jennings and students from UD. We have a big volunteer crew for that part of it who will be facilitating the projection. So it'll be a new way of sort of projecting our community on a historic object.
Local artist Terry Welker speaking with WYSO's Juliet Fromholt about the You Are Here project. You can experience it next Friday at Courthouse Square in downtown Dayton as part of Urban Nights.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today I'm speaking with Ron Elving. He's the senior Washington editor for NPR. Thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you again, Emily.
You've covered both conventions now. I'm just wondering, are Ohio delegates being wooed to the same degree that they were at the Republican convention last week?
You bet they are. If anything, they're getting even more. It's a tremendous focus for this campaign to win Ohio. A Republican has never been elected president without Ohio, as you know. So if the Democrats can win Ohio, they feel like they're over the top. So we saw in the calling of the roll of the states on Wednesday night the honor of putting the president over the top. Not that there was any suspense, but the honor, and this is a tradition, of being the state that gets to cast the votes that mean it's done, he's the nominee, he's our guy, and that always sets off a big celebration. That honor went to the state of Ohio.
You mentioned, yeah, that no Republican has ever been elected as to the presidential office without Ohio. Do Democrats need Ohio the same way that Republicans do?
Not quite, but it to some degree is two sides of the same coin. If you can deny the Republicans Ohio, that means you're probably winning Pennsylvania and Michigan. It means you're probably winning New York, Illinois, Wisconsin. And once you've pretty much colored in around the large states of the Great Lakes, maybe setting Indiana to one side, you've got it. That means you're winning in all the most populous states of the North and the East. That probably means in contemporary politics that you're also dominating on the West Coast, and you're going to have the presidency as a consequence. So it's an absolute for Republicans. They just feel they have to have Ohio. They've never won the presidency without it. So if the Democrats can just take key piece, that cornerstone away from the Republican coalition, it's a sign they're going to win. So they go after it pretty hot and heavy, and it was a very important part of the Obama campaign in 2008, and they're replicating that this year.
Many of the Democratic delegates here are talking about the speech by former Governor Ted Strickland. He gave a speech Tuesday night. What does it mean for the Obama campaign to have someone like Ted Strickland speaking like that?
Ted Strickland really tore the bark off of the Republican Party and the campaign that it's been running. He used the word lying, which is an unusual word in our politics. Media people tend to shy away from it. Politicians themselves will use just about any other synonym for lying. It's a bit of a fighting word. It's something that sets people off. But in some instances, you will hear people finally get to the juncture where they say, you just got to call it what it is. And in Ted Strickland's mind, it was necessary to do that with respect to some of the campaign ads that we've seen from some of these independent groups, as they're called, or dark money groups, if you will, that are supporting the Republican cause this year, and he wanted to call them out. It was interesting that he also drew a little bit on his background as a Methodist minister to quote some scripture in a particularly pointed way when he was talking about the passage, I believe it's in the book of Matthew, where it is said that where your treasure is, there shall your heart be also. He was referring, of course, at that point to some of the money that Republican candidate Mitt Romney has in the Cayman Islands and Switzerland and so on, and suggesting that it's not entirely patriotic to have your money invested offshore to stay away from some of the tax exposure when you're talking about how much America needs to reduce its deficit.
We heard a lot more about social issues at the Democratic convention than we did at the Republican convention. Is this at all an appeal to independents, or is this more rallying the base?
It is rallying the base, but the degree of attention that's been paid to it and the relentlessness of the emphasis on it suggests that the Democrats' polling shows them that women voters, whom they are pursuing ardently, are with them on some of the social issues, or at least the people they're trying to reach are with them on social issues. And I'm not just talking about abortion or abortion rights or contraception or access to health care, but also about the general issues of health care and education and spending by the government to help people as a general concept. That is all more popular among women than it is among men. And that's why the emphasis on those social issues is an outreach to independent women and even some Republican women, as well as an appeal to the Democratic base.
I've been speaking with Ron Elving. He's the senior Washington editor for NPR. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, two guitarists with over 150 years of playing experience between them. Jazzman Les Paul invented a new sound and a new guitar. And Delta Bluesman Honey Boy Edwards rambles in for memories and music. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
This afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, 91.3 WYSO.